And good morning. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Ellen Kamine, the natural nurse. And as always, we are wishing you the best. I'd love you to tune in to some of the wonderful things that we have going on at naturalnurse.com. If you go to naturalnurse.com and go to schedule, and I know so many of you do, you'll see we have a vast array of classes coming up, many of which are free. And believe it or not, some of them are in person. How exciting is that? We have a special going on right now for a free series, which is called Proven. It's an excellent docu-series. If you go to naturalnurse.com and click on calendar, or if you got our newsletter, it's listed there as well. And it's about the fact that medical care is both a science and a connection between the patient and the healer. Hello?
My image is not on the screen.
There's no image. There's no image. It's just audio. Okay. Are we doing audio?
No, I am right here. I'm just going to get the image on.
Okay, no image. There's no image.
Wait a minute. It's going to be
just audio, no image. Okay.
We're trying to get it. Was a few minutes. Do you see me now?
I see you, but you can turn off your camera. This is an audio show.
Oh, you want to turn off it as an image?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but are we here? I don't know if are you hearing us on? Are you there?
I'm hearing you loud and clear.
Okay, very good. So stand by. We're doing an intro of the up and coming things, and then we'll introduce you, Dr. Michael.
Okay.
So just stand by. So another class that we have coming up, free to all our listeners, we have a wonderful one for practitioners called Lion's Mane Raws, the magic, the mystery, and the multitude of benefits about lion's mane, how you can use that for an herb. And there is so much new research going on the immune supporting capacity of lion's mane and also helping with increased mental function and mood. It's a mysterious herb. It's has a multitude of benefits, and we have a free webinar coming up about it. Just go to naturalnurse.com calendar, and you will see that. We also have one coming up called Liver Detoxification and Blood Sugar Regulation, and that's along with my colleague, Dr. Lynn Lafferty, about how to become a health investigator. That's coming right up in a week. And all of these classes are available on Zoom. We also have the ongoing Natural Nurse Herbal Certification class, and that has CE units available for most health professionals, such as nurse practitioners, nurses, registered dietitians, people like that. And you can join in on that with 18 CEU credits, or if you don't need CEU credits, you can take the Natural Nurse Herbal Certification course. And that actually leads to 18 CEUs if you need them, or just take it without the CEUs. Either way, it can be used for your own information, or it could be used as part of your training to become a registered herbalist. We have an entire course on how to make natural living your life professionally. Of course, you have an interest in it, or you wouldn't be one of our listeners here on The Natural Nurse on Dr. Z. And we have another health investigator course on energy and sleeping. How are your adrenals? So a whole class about adrenals. Then we have Meetup Mondays, which is totally free. And right now we're running a Hildegard study group. And if you go to naturalnurse.com and then go to calendar, you will see a way to just sign up for free. It's a Meetup Monday studying about Hildegard, who was a brilliant, actually nun, who developed an entire protocol of healing using gemstones and using herbal medicine and botanicals and food. And that was back in the century that started with 10. That's how long ago. And she lived into when it was 11. That is when she did her work. Absolutely amazing. And we have an online beach herbal walk coming up. I mean, I'm sorry, in person. in person, one of our first ones. It's being run by the American Herbalist Guild Long Island chapter. It is totally free, and it'll be a beach walk in June where we go out and actually look at all the edible and medicinal plants that grow right here on the beach in Oyster Bay. Then we have a full edible and medicinal herb walk at Restoration Farm coming up in Old Bethpage, and also our medicine making workshop, which is where we actually prepare, go out and gather plants for a whole day, and then we make them into medicine. So you go home with all the things that you made, like extracts and tinctures and salves. So that is a really exciting program that we have up and coming right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So we would like to bring on board our guest today. And our guest today is Dr. Michael McGee. He's an MD, a surgeon, and a medical researcher. And he spent his early childhood internationally, born in Egypt, and he was in Germany and England. And then after attending the University College Hospital Medical School in London, he successfully completed his medical training and won a scholarship to Boston, where he did a surgical residency at Harvard Medical School, and also studied human nutrition, which brings him to our show right here, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and that was at MIT. And he is the founder and editor emeritus of Nutrition, the International Journey of Applied and Basic Nutritional Sciences. He wrote a book, a new book called Roots and Branches, which we'll be talking about today, where he shares his remarkable journey about overcoming early childhood trauma to become a renowned surgeon and research scientist. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Michael.
Good morning, Ellen. Thank you for inviting me, and good morning, audience.
Now, we have quite a while to speak today because this is a full hour show. So you really can go into, you know, sometimes I know when you're a guest on shows, you do little sound bites. But in this show, we can really go into your amazing story of, you know, what I would say really is overcoming childhood trauma. And of course, trauma is very much in the news. So we have so many topics to discuss, and especially from a content level, your deep dive into nutrition as a medical doctor. So that's another very appropriate thing for us to look into, because this show is called, the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and Dr. Z is a naturopathic physician. So let's first go and talk about what happened in your childhood.
Well, really, the story starts when I was in New York City on a Friday night in a taxi, and I had a massive heart attack. And when I was in the emergency room and then later on the ICU, I asked the old age question, who am I and why? And the answer is rooted in a story of love and longing based on a fatal accident in an upper Egyptian village over a century ago. And it's a very rich and powerful story where I explore my early life based on a series of over 1,500 letters, journals, and photos that my parents left. And essentially, at the age of four, I was uprooted from a cozy Egyptian family to be abandoned by my parents in impoverished post-war 1940 Germany. And in this vivid biography of my formative years, I write about my childhood. I was alone. I felt forsaken and often threatened by corporal punishment, which defined my earlier youth. The problem really lay in the fact that I had an Egyptian father and a German mother, and my mother refused to adapt to Egyptian life, resulting in domestic upheavals. And the root of the issue was that to marry my father, she gave up her education and opportunities in Europe, And he promised her that as soon as he'd taken care of his academic obligations in Cairo, he would take her back to Europe for her to finish her education. However, in the meantime, she had two children. There was a Second World War. And so when the opportunity arose, my parents left Egypt and returned to Europe. My father took a job in England, and so as not to have the children around, we were dumped with our German grandparents in Hamburg.
Okay, so that started out. But when you say dumped, you weren't exactly in an orphanage. You were at your grandparents.
That's right. But these were grandparents that we didn't know. We had grandparents in Egypt. We knew we had grandparents. But at age four, why we have a second set of grandparents suddenly? And they are in post-war Germany, where they have rationing, food rationing, where there are coupons, where we don't speak the language, where we don't know the culture. And these were elderly folks who had survived two world wars and were hardly in a position to raise a four-year-old me and a seven-year-old sister. And my grandfather defined living with them by his very rigid Prussian rules. We had to eat what was in front of us, what was put in front of us. And it usually was turnip and a piece of potato, and if we were lucky, some fish. And that is a huge difference from the lush food and fruit that we had in Egypt. And then for our parents to disappear without telling us where they're going to, without knowing how long they were going to be gone for, was really very devastating.
Well, I can imagine that. And they didn't tell you, you know, why they did leave you there? They didn't explain that to you at all?
They certainly may have, but for a four-year-old whose life is disrupted from an idyllic life in Cairo to this very gray, bombed-out Hamburg, it was incomprehensible.
That could certainly be traumatic. And so then what happened?
Well, we, in order to survive, really, children are very resilient and they adapt. And so I forgot my Arabic and I learned German, went to a German school till I was about eight. And then suddenly out of the blue, my parents appeared. In the meantime, I had transferred my love and affection to my grandmother, my German grandmother, who was a very affectionate, rotund, loving person. And now a woman comes into the house and says to me, "I'm your mother, you're coming with me, we're going to England." That was a huge emotional fight. The transference in emotional loyalty had already occurred. So my grandmother remained throughout my life my emotional mother, and my biological mother was a, so to say, passenger who rode along with me in my life. And both lived to a ripe old age.
Wow, that's a blessing.
It was indeed, yes.
So then you lived in England also. Now it's a whole new culture, a new society. And this is also post-war, so was there damage?
Yes.
That was a struggle at that time too, right?
And it was a struggle, and I had to learn a new language. And I remember coming home from the first day of school and asking my mother in German, obviously, when I asked the children here what their names are, they say, "Call me Andrew, call me John, call me Peter." I said, "They all have the same first name." And she said, "Well, what is that?" I said, "They say, call me." So I didn't realize that I didn't know the language and I had to learn English. And after 2 years of living in an English society and learning English and being a Boy Scout and being very comfortable in England, there was the coronation, which we watched on television. I was became a very proud English schoolboy. I forgot my German. My father says, okay, he's finished his studies. My mother's finished her studies. So we returned to Egypt.
Oh, no.
So at the age of 10, I returned to Egypt feeling very uncomfortable, not knowing the language, finding myself being a stranger once more. And my father was a renowned professor of Arabic, yet his son didn't speak a word of Arabic, so it caused an immense degree of shame. And he got me a tutor. I had to learn Arabic. And a 10-year-old boy really wants to play. He doesn't want to be sitting and studying all day long. And I did poorly in my first Arabic exam. I scored, I think, 30. And my father, who by that time was working for United Nations in Beirut, wrote me a very terse letter saying that life is too comfortable for you. If you had no father, you might do better. And I got the letter on a Thursday, and on Friday he died.
Oh no, that's
so upsetting. I lived with that problem of having to satisfy a father who was not around, and constantly struggle with that burden.
Right, that would be traumatic. Now, did you get, I mean, obviously, were you, through all this trauma, were you having kind of any symptoms that might be good to see a psychotherapist for, or nobody paid any attention to that in those days?
Yes, that's right. I'm not even sure they exist in those days. You know, during the course of writing this book, which is one of a four-part series called A Surgeon's Tale, and this is the first part, Roots and Branches. During this writing, I came across many of the issues that I was dealing with. And after a life of operating for 45 years, I began to realize that there are many people in our society who have had equally traumatic childhoods. And they manifest with a series of symptoms that I began to recognize in myself. Namely, one was chronic anxiety. The other one was a sense of uncertainty, not knowing what's going to happen next. Difficulty in bonding, because I had transferred my childhood, I transferred my maternal love to a different person who was not around after a certain number of years. And so there are a whole constellation of symptoms which go together with such traumatic childhood. And it wasn't until 1992 that a psychiatrist recognized this in her patients and put these symptoms together into what she called complex PTSD. And it comes to pass that about 25% of the U.S. population, the U.S. is my home, I've lived here 50 years, spent my entire life, professional life here, that 25% of the population suffer from this complex PTSD, where they have had rough childhoods with alcoholic parents or unemployed parents, or had to be raised by grandparents in the absence of a loving family unit. And these symptoms are throughout our population, and it is when you become sensitized to them, you begin to realize that you're not the only one suffering these burdens, but a lot of people are suffering from them, and you become much more understanding and acknowledging other people's pain.
That is true. And then when you see something as a syndrome, I think that's kind of hopeful because you know that there are actually steps of recognition of what you're going through and then steps of honoring it and moving past it. Now, I know of a case that you might have some insight on. This is a brother and a sister. They are now around, I would say, 45 years old, you know, in that age, a couple of years apart. They had a very traumatic upbringing with a father who was an abuser and regularly beat their mother in front of them. They lived something that might be considered, you know, more traumatic. Of course, with each of us, it's different, but they were in and out of domestic violence homeless shelters, you know, not too great.
Yeah, yeah.
And but when I look at these two people, I see that their personal dealing with it is so different, because while the son really became basically a criminal and beats all the women who have ever been in his life and their family.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Yes.
And their families are in and out of homeless shelters.
Yes.
But the woman with the same upbringing, she is also overcompensating, but like she can't be perfect enough. She's not only a pharmacist, she's a PhD.
Yes.
She not only was in the army, but she was like a lieutenant major. She's not only has a house, it has to be 8,000 square feet. You know, so it's like the same thing I could see in both of them.
Yes.
But the way they are compensating is really different.
Right. And you put your finger on it. The sad thing is that sometimes the offsprings who've suffered through these childhood traumas will repeat this behavior with their children and with those around them. They are generally angry and there's rage, and they will just lash out at anybody who really is trying to help them, other family members. And then there's the other side of it, which you very elegantly described, namely the overcompensation of being super perfect and being super acceptable. So that when just want to point out that when her seminal paper was published in 1992, Dr. Judith Herman described these interpersonal traumas in children who could not escape from it. And you gave a very nice example. And this trauma, interestingly enough, wreaks havoc in the development and formation of basic personality characteristics in these individuals, in infants, in children, and young adults. And it leaves a physical imprint in the brain and body. So it is not just something that is in passing, it actually leaves it on them. And in fact, during the course of my going through Harvard and MIT and having practiced surgery on the West Coast and then settled in New York, I have seen peers and people around me who have manifested these symptoms. And they don't know that they're manifesting them, but they arise from the panic of loneliness. That's the biggest issue, feeling lonely. And then the shame that you think the reason you're being treated that way is because you've done something, and obviously you haven't. And then, as I mentioned, there's this chronic anxiety and the inability to concentrate and difficulties in remembering, and the lack of trust in other people and the yearning for acceptance. And that is what you describe in the lady who is this super duper number one, an alpha woman.
That is so true. Well, we have to take a little break right here, and we will be back shortly. I want to advise our listeners that you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We'd love you to join us on many workshops and books that we have written right here at Dr. Eugene Samperone and myself. So you go to naturalnurse.com to look around there. And today we have as our guest, Dr. Michael McGeed. He is the author of Roots and Branches, a Family Saga Like No Other. He's been describing that to us, and we will continue our discussion. And we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss jojoba, the miracle plant of the desert.
Jojoba is spelled J-O-J-O-B-A, but is pronounced according to its Spanish origins. The jojoba plant grows in the American Southwest and the Sonoran Desert in Mexico. The jojoba is a large bush-like plant resembling mistletoe. It can reach a height of 15 feet and can live from 100 to 200 years. The Sonoran Indians have used the oil pressed from the jojoba beans for centuries. Father Juniper Serra, founder of 21 missions in California, noted in the early 1700s that the local Indians were using jojoba oil for treating sores, cuts, bruises, burns, and as a diet supplement, to soothe skin from sun and wind burns, as a cooking oil, and even as a beverage.
The importance of jojoba as a cash crop was proclaimed in 1935. But it was not until 1974, when the killing of sperm whales was banned, that the government began to study jojoba oil in depth as a substitute for whale oil. The National Academy of Sciences concluded jojoba oil has a radically different chemical structure than any other known oil. Most oils break down or turn rancid. Jojoba, on the other hand, is hypoallergenic, non-toxic, never turns rancid, and does not break down even under high temperature and pressure.
The University of California at Riverside did a study where they cooked 27 batches of popcorn in the same heated jojoba oil. The last batch was just as perfect as the first. These unusual properties are unique to jojoba oil because, chemically speaking, jojoba oil is not really an oil at all, but is a liquid wax. Its composition is almost identical to sebum, which is the oil secreted by human sebaceous glands to help to protect the skin from the environment.
Jojoba has a myriad of usages. The cosmetic industry takes advantage of its compatibility to human skin by adding it to shampoos, conditioners, moisturizers, and many other cosmetic products. In medicine, jojoba can be used directly on rashes, cuts, and psoriasis. It may also be used as a lubricant for artificial hearts. Jojoba contains a natural appetite suppressant, which can be used in weight loss products. It has no known side effects. In industry, jojoba is known to be a superior engine lubricant and will cause a car to run 20 to 30 degrees cooler when added to the crankcase oil.
So, if you are interested in a miracle plant from the desert, reach for jojoba in your natural medicine chest.
And welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. We invite you to go to naturalnurse.com and go to calendar, where we have so many classes available. For instance, right now we have a link to a wonderful series called Proven, and that is totally free. And you can just go to naturalnurse.com. Look at calendar and you'll see the list of free classes that we have and other classes that have a small fee that also involve getting CE credits if you are a nurse, nurse practitioner, registered dietitian, licensed massage therapist, midwife, licensed acupuncturist. We have CE units for all of those, but the classes are open to anyone, whether you need that or not. And perhaps you're thinking about how could you do natural for your personal and professional life. So personally, of course, you can integrate natural remedies, both with natural foods and herbs and homeopathics, and learn about them for yourself personally. But professionally, there are many avenues that you can go down in order to integrate natural into how you earn a living. And we have an entire class called Career Paths in Natural Health that we do on a one-on-one level, and all kinds of opportunities. So go to naturalnurse.com and look around and explore. Today, we are so happy to have as our guest, Dr. Michael McGeed. He is the author of his book, Roots and Branches, A Family Saga Like No Other. And he also has written other books that we'll ask him about. And he's a surgeon, medical researcher, and has a long list of training. He is also a fellow to the American College of Surgeons and has many other national and international honorary fellowships. And he also was a participant of the Vatican and Nobel conferences on human nutrition and also consulted with NASA in terms of nutrition. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. McGeed.
Thank you for inviting me. This is a delightful discussion.
Now, you shared quite a bit about you being basically thrown around, literally around the world as a child, and the sequelae of events that for you precipitated a lot of anxiety and a lot of confusion in terms of, you know, where do you live, who are you, et cetera.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're also a child of mixed heritage, such as
Yes. My
children. My children are, you know, I am Jewish and their father is Afro-American. So they've had a lot of also these internal things to deal with about who am I. And so in your case, it was also like international. So that is interesting. But then you also shared with us already that there are different people that compensate for those psychological difficulties different ways. And I would say, Dr. McGeed, with all due respect, you are in that group that we mentioned earlier in the show about overcompensating.
Like
you can't have enough degrees. How many degrees do you need, Dr. McGeed?
Yes, I would agree with you there. Yes, indeed. But you know, it took me many years to understand that phenomenon. Actually, it took me writing the series A Surgeon's Tale, which consists of four books, to come to that realization.
Wait, let's say the name of that, A Surgeon's Tale.
Tale, yes.
So that's another book besides Roots and Branches, and it's a
series
of books.
The series is called A Surgeon's Tale, and the first book in that series is Roots and Branches, which takes me up to the age of 16.
Okay.
And then the second book in the series is called Mastering the Knife, which is subtitled Seeking Identity and Finding Belonging.
Well, there you go.
Which is really my life as a medical student, joining the medical profession and the surgical profession. That's the identity and the belonging. But the identity is a little bit more subtle. The identity is really exactly the points that you touched on with your children. Who am I? All right. Am I this or am I that? And that takes more than just education. That takes a lot of insight into one's own personality and an understanding of what happens and how one reacts to situations. And now I'm very fortunate to have had a very stoic and loving wife who was exceedingly tolerant and in helping me get to the conclusion of what I was really wrestling with and dealing with. Because you mentioned how qualified you have to be. I also had an NIH-funded research lab. And we did some very fundamental, basic scientific, neuroscientific research to understand the question, why when you are sick, do you lose your appetite? Why when you have a cold? Why when you have cancer or you have inflammatory bowel disease or any major ailment, do you lose your appetite and stop eating when in fact you should be eating more to compensate for the energy the body requires to help the healing process? So I had this very active research lab for 25 years, and obviously it attracted NASA because they have a problem that the astronauts lose their appetite and they lose weight, when in fact you don't want them to reach Mars and have be so weak that they can't get out of their capsule. So I consulted with them, and this was obviously a very important question to the Vatican, because there are so many people in this world who are poor and starving. And how does the body respond to that phenomenon? And we had looked at all these different issues. And yes, that was what I call my surgery was my bread and butter. I would operate to earn a living. And the research I did was my opium. That is what kept me interested, kept me alive, kept me going. The next question, what happens now? What comes next? A huge sense of curiosity. And as you correctly point out, you somewhat bury yourself in your work in order not to face the demons that hound you. But after retirement and then the ability to sit down and to write my own memoir with a huge wealth of letters that my mother typed, my own journals, and boxes and boxes of photographs from people I didn't even know, that one went back and researched, I was able to begin to understand myself and to realize that what I really suffered from, what I lived, was what 30 years before Judith Herman even put it into a scientific paper that she, 30 years before she even had it classified as a diagnosable problem. And it has helped me in telling the story. Not only was I able to confront and purge some of these demons, but I learned to appreciate and have a deeper empathy for those who lived with similar afflictions. And believe me, once you're aware of these symptoms, you see them with people around you who are adults, but they're manifesting childlike behavior, which are imprints in the brain created at the time that they suffered similar injuries. The injury varies, but that's what happens to the brain.
Right, and then they're reactive accordingly, one way or another.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd like to make one quote. You know, people say, oh, get over it. But I found a very interesting quote from an Italian football striker. That's not our kind of football. I'm talking about soccer.
And a striker, you have to remind America is that. Right.
And the striker is the person who is the lead guy who tries to gain a goal. And his name is Mario Bottolini. And he quoted the following. He said, some say abandonment is a wound that never heals. I say only an abandoned child never forgets. So that very nicely summarizes the injuries that people have sustained as children. They don't forget them. And in my life, I have encountered hostility in adults directed at various situations totally inappropriately. And I remember on one occasion, I took my boss aside and I said to him, if you are angry, why don't you direct your anger at that particular individual, but not at this group of people who are trying to help you? And he immediately stopped and realized what was going on. And it was like throwing a light switch. He changed his behavior towards the people who were in the room, who were actually his faculty, who were trying to help him overcome a problem.
But also in your particular case, you shared with us that the person that you married, you did not establish, which I see so often happen in people who are traumatized, they establish once again that pattern where there would be additional abandonment again and again. And it sounds like you overcame that by, you know, having a wife that was supportive of you.
Yes. And by actually, you know, the process of recognizing what is going on, the burdens and the demons one is dealing with, it's a process. In my particular case, I never drank, so I couldn't become an alcoholic. I had to have my faculties around with me in order to function as a surgeon and a scientist, and therefore was never drawn to escapism, you know, doing other behavior that would be counterproductive. But having a wife who was understanding and who could see something is bothering you, which is very difficult to verbalize because it means you have to fess up to it. You have to say, yeah, that is me. And yeah, from time to time, you see these people with these problems go off their rail. They will transgress. They will become alcoholics. They will behave in ways that we consider antisocial, but which in fact is their attempt at trying to come to terms with their sense of behavior.
Well, thank you for sharing that. So as we continue our show today, I'd like to remind our listeners that you are listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. And in a few minutes, we'll take a little break. In fact, we'll take a little break now, since we're at a break, in which Progressive Radio Network can tell you about some of the other wonderful shows that they have right here. You can always find out more at prn.fm. And we're so happy that you're joining us today for our show right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and our conversation with Dr. Michael McGeed, who is the author of Roots and Branches, a Family Saga Like No Other. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Please visit us at naturalnurse.com. Click on calendar to see all about the classes and workshops that are coming up. Click on books to see the many books that we've written. And of course, on radio shows, it links to our archive of hundreds and hundreds of radio shows. We've been doing two or three shows a week since 1987, believe it or not. In those days, they were called radio shows. I think that's the same thing that's called podcast now. I don't know. I don't know the difference. Maybe you do, listeners. Anyway, lots and lots of content available for free through naturalnurse.com. And I want to thank you so much for joining us today and listening to our brilliant and wonderful guest, Dr. Michael McGeed. He is the author of Roots and Branches, a Family Saga Like No Other. So welcome back, Dr. Michael.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, I would like to go into this migration of interest, because you had not been doing enough as a surgeon. Now, you know, the migration over to nutrition, because that's what our audience is like actually quite focused on. How a highly trained doctor like yourself with medical training and actually went to MIT for human nutrition. And then you got deeply involved in that because you're the editor of Nutrition, the International Journal of Applied and Basic Nutritional Sciences. That's a pretty deep dive into nutrition.
Yes, it's an interesting transition that I never thought would happen, but I'll let your audience know how it happened. I was, after finishing my training in Boston, I was appointed as a professor at one of the Boston hospitals. In fact, it was Boston City Hospital. And one night when I was on call around 4 in the morning, I get a call from my residents telling me that they have an emergency. A man slipped off a windowsill that he was trying to break into an apartment, and he has life-threatening bleeding, and would I come in immediately? So I told him, go ahead, take this man whose name was Leroy, take him to the OR, and I'll join you. Because it took me about 20 minutes to drive from my home to Boston City Hospital. And when I got there, I saw Leroy. The first and most striking thing I will tell you was that he was about 18 years old. He had a beautiful body. He had obviously worked out. He had this thick neck. He had a six-pack abdomen. He had beautiful muscles in his arms and legs. This individual had invested a lot of time in building his body, whereas I had invested a lot of time in building my brain. And so I remember looking at his eyes, and he looked, stared back at me. He was already intubated, and he had IVs in every vein. We were giving him as much fluid as possible to try and keep his blood pressure up because he was bleeding massively from an internal organ. And to save his life, we would have to do a crash anesthetic induction and then operate on him immediately to try and stop the bleeding. And when he gazed at me, he was transmitting a message that I am going to die. Will you save me? And I looked at him, and my answer is yes, I am here to save you. And we immediately put him to sleep, and we poured a bottle of betadine over his abdomen and draped him. And as we were doing that, I saw that his left leg was sort of funny shaped, and I realized he also has a fracture of his femur, his large bone in his leg. And so we had already gotten x-ray in the ER, and it showed that he did have the fracture there. But I very, very hesitantly, together with my team, I very hesitantly made an incision that goes from the pubic bone all the way up to the zypha to the chest, expecting huge amounts of blood to come out. And when I got into his abdomen and looked at the most likely organs that would get damaged with this fall from a fourth floor, his liver, his spleen, they were all normal. I looked at all his bowel, that was all normal. I looked at his pancreas, it was normal. There was no evidence of massive bleeding in his abdomen to explain his very low blood pressure and his ability, the possibility that he might bleed to death. And then I realized what probably happened, which gave us a false positive test, was that blood was trickling from his fractured leg along his back into his abdomen. And the tiny amount of blood we found there was actually due to his leg fracture, and it was a massively swollen leg fracture. So we called the orthopedic team in, and I closed the abdomen together with my team, feeling very sorry that we had scarred this very beautiful bone body. But I was so relieved because I felt this 18-year-old kid will survive because he didn't have a liver injury or a spleen injury or pancreatic injury. He just had a fractured leg bone, which the orthopedic team came in. They came in around 5:30 in the morning, and we slid out of the OR, and they slid in and they fixed his leg. And I felt at that moment that Leroy was lucky. He was going to live and go home. Now, they put him in the first bed in the ICU. And since it was an orthopedic team that did this, they were responsible for him. And every day as I went to the ICU in the morning and in the evening to see my own patients, I would pass Leroy. And after 30 days, I went into the ICU and Leroy's bed was empty. So I thought, oh, he's been moved from the ICU probably to the wards. And I asked the nurses, where's Leroy? And they said he died. I couldn't believe it. How can an 18-year-old man with this beautiful, massive, muscular body die? So I went into the basement of the hospital, dug up his record, and calculated how much nutrients he had consumed whilst in hospital and compared that to the amount of calories that he really required to get over this massive fracture, the blood loss, and all the trauma that goes with that. And he had essentially been sustained. Now, you must remember, this was 1967. That was standard of care then. He had been sustained by 3 units of 5% glucose in saline, which each unit provides about 500 calories. So he'd been sustained by 1,500 calories per day, when in fact his energy requirement was something like 3,200 calories. So that Leroy had died from undernutrition, from starving to death in a major hospital in Boston. And I felt so absolutely terrible that this event happened. And I decided I needed to learn something about nutrition so that we can avoid this kind of mistake happening again. And there were only 2 programs in 1967 that taught human nutrition. All the other hospitals or training programs taught animal husbandry. But human nutrition was taught at MIT and at Berkeley. And since I was already working in Boston, it was easier to go to MIT. And I signed up at MIT to learn about human nutrition. And that is how I got drawn into nutrition. And in fact, my own surgical patients did very well, either after trauma or after a big cancer operation, if they were supported by proper intravenous or GI nutritional feeding. And it was at a time when industry was ramping up to develop all the nutrients and tubes and catheters that we currently use to help support patients who are unable to eat. And so it was Leroy and his misadventure that I was printed in a article in the Columbia Medical Review, but which is coming out in my 4th book, which is called Great Joys and Great Sorrows. It was Leroy who drew me into the nutrition field for a surgeon, which was rather unusual in those days.
Oh, much so. What an absolutely fabulous story. Thank you so much for that. Now, as you know, I think nutrition is actually on the rise in terms of interest, both in what I'm in, which is the natural medicine field. That's what we always do. And we honor surgery as well as sort of a last-ditch effort, but feel that many times, especially for the use, just the ongoing use of pharmaceuticals, a better path might be to pay more attention to your nutrition first and see, you know, how we could stay away from needing a lot of the pharmaceuticals. But surgery is always definitely necessary, like you just described, with accidents, et cetera. But what's one, you know, we're getting to the end of our time together. It's been a fascinating discussion, Dr. Michael. But what is one little piece of nutritional advice, like maybe some of the newer research that you could share with our audience?
I think that we have worked out pretty well over the last 30 years or so how much energy different forms of trauma or injuries require. And by injuries, I mean things like cancers and so on, chronic illnesses that people deal with on an ongoing basis. If you don't eat enough, if you don't get enough of the suitable nutrition, you will break down your own body for that disease process to survive. So adequate nutrition is very important, and we have learned a great deal how to deliver it and what to deliver. But sometimes doctors forget, and it's quite appropriate to remind doctors, hey, do I need the following? Do I need some more nutrition support? And they will remember and they will provide it to you. What we do not know, and which is still open for research, is what non-standard nutritional methods can one give to patients? What is sometimes euphemistically called alternative therapy, or what we call natural nutrients, as you have demonstrated on this program. That remains to be researched and to be incorporated in the standardized pharmaceutical world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your really in-depth and heartfelt sharing about, you know, your life and your adventures, as well as the great research that you have done as like an international citizen, which you certainly are, and sharing so much information with the world and with your colleagues and through Nutrition, the International Journal of Applied and Basic Nutritional Sciences. So thank you so much. If you have any parting words for our audience, please share those.
I would like to thank you for indulging in my stories and in my tales, and I will encourage you to continue listening to Ellen.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com. And on behalf of myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone, until next time, we hope that you stay healthy.